We're going to hear today a rebroadcast of an interview that aired in February of last year with Margaret Rinkel, author of the novel Wash. Since this interview aired, the novel has won the Flaherty Dunnan First Novel Prize. It was a finalist for the 2014 Chautauqua Prize. It was listed as Time Magazine's 21 Female Authors You Should Be Reading, named a best book by the Wall Street Journal, was an editor's pick at the New York Times. It was a top 10 pick by O Magazine, and much, much more. It's an absolutely wonderful book, and I thought maybe our dear listeners would like to hear this program once more. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Margaret Rinkel. She is a writer, documentary filmmaker, and visual artist. Her debut novel is called Wash. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is, I mean, I have to say, I do read quite a bit of fiction, and some of it's okay and some of it's good. This is tremendous. This is I hope will be a classic of American literature, and it is so deeply felt and historically profound. It's about the life and journey of a slave whose name is Washington, or Wash for short, which is the title of the book, who was born in the very end of the 18th century and basically lives a life in slavery in the American South. You are from Birmingham, Alabama. This is part of your history.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I was born in Birmingham in 1963. In the summer of 1963, right after Martin Luther King's campaign in Birmingham and the fire hoses and the dogs, and right before the bombing in September that killed the four little girls. So I think that coming into that place in the world at that time sort of situated me in a way to tell the story, because like a lot of white Southerners, I have slaveholding ancestors, and like a lot of white Southerners, some of my earliest relationships were with the black people who were being paid to take care of me, who were probably descended from those that my ancestors held in bondage. And so my life, those two lines, those two storylines came together in my life. And I think growing up in that situation, crossing racial boundaries with divided loyalties, made me want to put those two different stories into one.
One of the themes of this book is, I didn't know anything about this, but this whole practice, and maybe you can tell us how widespread it was, of actually breeding slaves so that they could sell the offspring of desirable slaves, and this guy Wash was put into that kind of servitude.
Well, yeah, I didn't know about it. I mean, when I stumbled across a rumor that it had happened, I wanted to know more. There was a rumor that an ancestor of mine had been involved in this practice, and I was never able to find any proof that he was. I was hardly able to find much proof of the practice. It's been very interesting when you go through the history of slavery, because the interpretations change with each decade, and they change with the bias of the writer. And the Birmingham Public Library has an incredible Southern collection, and they have kept a lot of books that a lot of people have gotten rid of that were politically incorrect. And so you can really see that shift. But very few history books even had slave breeding in the index. But I was able to find, and there's never been any documentation. There's been a huge debate about this, and a lot of black historians say it obviously happened. A lot of white historians say that it didn't happen because there's no proof. There's huge issues with proof in slavery, because half of the people involved were not allowed to be literate. And if proof rests on written documents, then. But I was able to find a three-line quote in an interview from a survivor of slavery. When they asked about this, he said, yes, there was this guy. And he was tall, and he was difficult, and he was isolated, and he was sent away for the weekend. And 9 months later, all these babies were born. And so I started writing the story trying to deal with my ancestors, my legacy of having slaveholding ancestors. But once I thought about that day of that man leaving for the weekend, Wash sort of emerged and took over the story.
Well, and he's such a powerful character, and every character in the book is a very real flesh and blood character. I feel like I know them by the time I've gotten even 100 pages in. I feel like I know them in a kind of intimate, real way where you can see and smell and hear their voices. How did you develop those characters? Did they come to you?
Well, you know, it's a mystery, really, what happens in the writing process. They never felt created by me. They felt like they were already present. So I don't really know how to talk about exactly what happens in the writing process, where your characters come from. And I've also, I think, always had trouble distinguishing between fiction and reality. I mean, we grew up without a TV, and because I was sort of haunted by the fictional things I saw on TV I thought were real. So I've always had a lot of fictional characters. I read a lot because we didn't have a TV, and a lot of fictional characters, I feel like they're people I know. Characters and books that are important to me, they feel like they're people that I know. And so I wanted to write in a way that would allow other people to feel that.
It's really vivid, and it also makes me think about one of the themes in the book, which is that the character Wash actually has a remarkably happy childhood for a slave, because he lives basically with his mother and one slave owner on an island. They're pretty much left alone, and she is from Africa, has come over very recently, and teaches him her spirituality, and there is this sense of the ancestors always being present and around you, and you being alive, but you will someday be one of the ancestors that is present and around the next generations of people. And in the same way, these characters, they feel like real, living American ancestors who are telling us our own story.
I'm so glad you got that. That's what they felt like to me.
It's so interesting and important, I think, for us as Americans, whether we be Northerners or Southerners or Westerners or whatever, to deal with this legacy, because I feel like we've been fighting the Civil War for centuries, maybe 400 years, in one way or another, and we still haven't dealt with this legacy. And, I mean, after World War II, there was a proliferation, and it's still going on, of German literature and film and books and art dealing with the Holocaust. But in a funny way, we, and especially white Americans, haven't really dealt with slavery and all the ways that it infuses into our society still.
Yes, I mean, there's a huge and really meaningful tradition of American literature that deals with slavery, both white and black, but I think every wave of it, you know, obviously you think of Faulkner, you think of Beloved, and you think, but each wave of it, there's this feeling of we're done, or we did it, or we're done. And I think people don't quite understand how this issue was at the heart of things from the very beginning.
Say more about that.
Well, I just think that, you know, people are critical about the Founding Fathers not dealing with slavery. I think people don't really understand that at that time, with the 13 colonies, if they had dealt with it at that time, there probably would not have been, I mean, and I'm not a historian, so, but there was a disagreement about this matter then, and the coalition of colonies was so small and so fragile that if they'd had this fight then, there probably would not have been a country. But that fight that they didn't have then, so that we could have a country, is a tear that is still tearing through everything. And it's actually was the current racial situation, the contemporary racial situation that I experienced teaching in inner city Birmingham and doing a documentary about race, that compelled me to write this book, which is set so long ago, because I realized during my work in racial reconciliation that a lot of the dynamics that are at play now were set in motion by slavery and are still affecting us. And the dynamics that were laid down in the past created patterns that we still move through and are not aware of how influenced we are by the past. And so I just felt like a lot of what I was seeing today was, and the misunderstandings that I was seeing today could be traced back to the immense cultural differences between traditional Africa and the modernizing European descended West. They're so different, and the way they came together into slavery, in slavery, created repercussions that are still affecting us.
Talk about some of those differences and examples of how you see them today.
Well, I think these are huge subjects, so I'm going to simplify, but these two different paradigms, the traditional African indigenous paradigm is that everything is connected, everything is animate. There's a reciprocal relationship between the living and the dead that is eternal, whereas a more modern Western viewpoint is much more secular. It's much more linear. It's much more oriented around chronological time, whereas a traditional indigenous spirituality is not linear. It's circular, and all times are connected through ceremony and ritual. Everything that's ever happened is still present. And if you look at these two paradigms and you look at history, we were just talking about how slavery is still present and the things that happened in slavery are still present and to us and affecting us. And so, I don't know, did I answer your question?
Well, yeah, I mean, so you have these very different paradigms, and I have to say the way you describe the African paradigm, spiritual paradigm, it sounds something like the Tibetan and a lot of other indigenous paradigms all around the world, and in a way our kind of secular enlightenment way of thinking is anomalous in the history of the world. It just has led to a lot of effective conquest, and so we think of it as universal.
Right, and it's, I think it was actually a Santa Fe writer, Kat Duff, who I first heard say, use the word cultural trance, that our current cultural trance is this, and this, that this secular, things are not connected, this enlightenment idea is the current dominant paradigm right now, but it is an anomaly.
Yeah, and it helps us build cars and make maps and get to the moon and find antibiotics and all kinds of lovely things.
Yes, but a lot of things are lost when you disconnect, when you speed things up and you make certain things possible, but you break certain connections that lead to a lot of other loss. And so for a long time I was looking at these two paradigms and trying to, which one is better, which one do we want? I think actually we've been in a time where one was dominant, we've been in a time where another is dominant. I think we're actually really lucky to live in a time where we're starting to see the limits of the current paradigm.
Right.
And we're starting to go to see the value in the other paradigm that was being left behind. And hopefully we're coming into a time of integration of the two paradigms, not one or the other, but to integrate them. As I actually think they're related to sides of the brain, but that's a whole other story.
Right. We're talking to Margaret Rinkle about her new novel, Wash. It's interesting, too, because there's a moment in the book which I think is relevant to what you're talking about, which is a moment where somebody says, and you can quote it better than I can, but for every good there's an evil.
There's some evil to balance every good.
There's some evil to balance every good. And that is also a very important concept because, again, that appears in almost, I think, probably every indigenous kind of spirituality, whereas we, with the kind of Judeo-Christian and Protestant spirituality that we, whatever you want to call it, way of thinking that we have, it's almost like good can overcome evil. And when you think that way, the evil goes underground and gets really ugly. Mm-hmm. And it looks like slavery.
Well, it gets buried. But just because it's buried doesn't mean that it's not affecting us.
Yeah.
And
it has, I mean, this is the thing about reading through this book and thinking, how can the people, and you describe Richardson, Wash's owner, so beautifully and with, I don't know how to say it, but just the right amount of compassion and understanding for him, because he's somebody who you want to hate, but you can't quite hate him as a reader because you give us the tools to understand who he is and where he's coming from. But you see a world in which the buying and selling of people is normalized.
Well, and it was, I think we need to remember, it, it was normalized through a lot of human history in a lot of places. Of course, American slavery took it to new levels that really hadn't been. But I felt like having a family connection to ancestors who were slaveholders, it was something I wanted to deal with myself. What does that mean to me now? But I also knew that that family connection would mean that I would have to view these people with some degree of compassion, which I knew...
The slave owners.
Yeah, because they were potential. They were people who were very like people who were connected to me, my people. So I knew that connection would lead me to view them with more compassion, which I felt would make the story more powerful because it makes it more tragic. I think a lot of stories of slavery tend to be from one side or the other and don't allow for the fullness of both sides, which is what makes it such a tragedy.
Exactly. And it also, I mean, we have such a, in a way, and particularly in our movie tradition, more than in the literary tradition, a kind of like comic book good guys and bad guys thing going on. And to see everybody in their fullness is sometimes challenging for us.
Yes, and I think it's important it was important to me to explore Richardson, even though it wasn't always comfortable, but because I think we all carry the capacity to abuse our power, and we need to reckon with that. And it's when it's not reckoned with is when you need to worry. You know?
Right.
And the other thing I think about with Richardson, if I apply the West African traditional paradigm, the ancestors don't just want to give us their victories. They need to give us their failures and their sins and their mistakes so that we can learn from them. Otherwise, their suffering and their mistakes are never redeemed, and their lives are that part of their lives are wasted, you know. So it's these legacies. There's not a lot of white Southerners only want to talk about the good things that their ancestors have done, but in the wholeness of it, for that reciprocal link between the living and the dead to be real, it has to include the mistakes and the sins and the failures. And just like us, we're doing things that we don't even see. And I just hope that down the road, whoever looks back at us looks back with some compassion.
Well, I think about that. I was thinking about this moment where Richardson goes and sees a slave woman for sale and buys her kind of on impulse. And I thought, okay, impulse purchase. What's our own version of an impulse purchase? And what are the human ramifications behind it that we don't see? And what are we doing when we invest in a gold mine? And then you start reading about how gold miners are suffering in South America, and we are making a return on our investment. And the only difference is that with slavery, the person is a human being right next to you, and in our current investment climate, it's further away.
Well, I think our current climate is really predicated on the fact that everything is separate. And when you start to think about everything being connected, then that changes everything. But I just wanted to go back to the scene you mentioned, because that actually is from a true story, that was handed down through a family of a woman talking about getting on the block and picking out a man and flirting with him to get him to buy her because he seemed more reasonable than the other men there.
Right.
And but I told the scene about this woman getting Richardson to buy her from Richardson's point of view. So he's supposed to be the powerful, you know, owner person, but she's the one who actually has the power in that scene. So that was interesting for me.
And that brings up a lot of questions that this book helps us to, or stimulates us to explore, which is, what is freedom, for example? What is inner freedom? What is inner freedom when you are enslaved, for example? What is freedom when you are the slaveholder?
And that was another thing I sort of started on this process so many years ago, thinking that slavery was the aberration. But after the experience of writing this book, I see that it's freedom. Freedom is the aberration. And I think that there's all different kinds of freedom, but I think that there's literal and metaphorical freedom. But I think that one of the reasons that freedom is an aberration is because it comes with a great amount of responsibility. And so it's a lot of people are ambivalent about that.
Or unable to use it wisely.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of history in this book, although it's kind of woven in and is not didactic. But one of the things that I thought was interesting was the whole question of going west and going west with or without slaves.
Yeah, the whole going west thing is so problematic because I think what I was surprised to learn in this book is that a lot of the soldiers that fought in the Revolutionary War, after the Revolutionary War, they needed to be paid. And the country, the new country, was broke and didn't have any money to pay them. So they paid them with land grants to land that they didn't even own. And so what Richardson does is he goes around and collects up these grants from other soldiers who don't know the value of them or whatever. But it's very complicated because the grants were to land that was Indian territory. And so that was a whole part of the westward expansion that I didn't know anything about, and how, in a way, it was problematic from the beginning there, too, because of the conflict over the land. But I'm not answering your question about the slaves. Obviously, there was a huge debate in slavery about how far it was going to go, and Kansas, and I don't want to get into my history is not strong enough, but the whole issue of whether they were going to allow slaves in the new Louisiana territory. And that was one of the things when I wasn't sure about the proof about slave breeding. I knew that there were a lot of enslaved people in the Virginia area, and the land had worn out, and there were a lot of people moving west, and there was a lot of demand for slaves on that western edge, but there weren't as many slaves there as there were back east. And so the dynamics, because there a lot of they could either move the slaves down from Virginia to where there was more demand, but that's a long walk. So I wondered what happened when the demand rose in that area, and that's what led me to the whole slave breeding thing, of how that could be possible if there was that demand.
Right. So when you were preparing for or in the process of writing this book, what kind of research did you do?
Well, I started, like I said, in the Southern Collection of the Birmingham Public Library, because they've kept everything. It would have included manuals, slave management manuals, you know, books by about the specific mechanics of how to run a plantation and discipline and all that. But I also used a lot of primary sources. I went through a lot of letters, journals, and in those letters, when I was sifting through looking for proof of the breeding, I started noticing that there was a lot of the letters were written very obliquely, and a lot of sort of wording of deals that you could tell had been talked about and then were written down in a way that could mean one way or could mean another. So I realized there was a lot of things, probably there were open secrets that there will never be any proof for, because the people who were writing these documents were conscious at the time of not leaving a paper trail. And so again, that raises the questions of proof. So I used a combination of primary sources, secondary sources, but the main thing was going to these places. I went to a lot of slavery-related places throughout the South.
Where did you go, and what did you do when you were there?
Well, I went to a lot of places that are open as museums, most of which, there's only one plantation that's open as a museum that's curated by a black descendant of the people who were enslaved there. It's called Somerset Place. It's in eastern North Carolina. And most of these places, there's a bit of the sort of glamorizing or romanticizing the Old South and the hoop skirts and the
Scarlett O'Hara.
And the manicured lawns and everything. Yeah. But Somerset, when you go to Somerset, you're taken into the master bedroom. The guide will tell you, this is the master bedroom and two people lived here, and this room is the size of one of the cabins for the enslaved people, and 10 people lived there in a space as big as this room.
It sounds like Santa Fe.
But a lot of the places that are sort of parceling out this history or presenting this story of slavery as museums to people are not presenting the full story. And one place I was particularly struck at, this beautiful manicured lawn with these trees, and it was just very serene. And I asked where the slave quarters were, and they pointed to this manicured lawn and said that that's where they were. And so that's when I realized that I was hunting a buried story. Because the woman told me about the cabins were there and about when they tore them down and about how they found what they found in the cabins before they tore them down. And they had used infrared photography to find the paths of the owner's garden that he designed, but they didn't really know much about, they didn't know where the slave cemetery was.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time walking around in woods looking for lost slave cemeteries.
Did you find any?
No, but I definitely, and some of the places I went to were abandoned. People saying that their cousin had some land that had some abandoned slave cabins in the back, and it was something they didn't tell a lot of people. And so I went there and stood there in those empty cabins and got a lot of what I needed.
We're talking to Margaret Rinkle about her novel, Wash. There is a theme running throughout of, and we all know the word mojo, but talk about what that is and what it is in your book.
Well, I mean, technically it's, and I'm probably not translating it directly, my understanding is that mojo is sort of translatable as a spark, as soul, as but a lot of people call traditional spirituality mojo, hoodoo, and most of the people, it depends on whether you're talking about it from the inside or the outside. Like, for example, in the book, when Wash is telling everything that his mother has taught him and this whole very sophisticated, elaborate system of belief of with the ancestors and our relation to them, and then it cuts to Thompson, and he says the first time I saw Mina at her mojo, she was burying something, and Wash has just been talking about her altars and how she has explained to him how to keep an altar and how to make offerings and how it keeps you thankful and it keeps you grateful and it keeps you in the right spiritual position. And then Thompson cuts in and says, well, first time I saw her doing her mojo. So, but it's a whole belief system and a whole spirituality that is vast and vital and complex that came from Africa and that was seen by the whites who were who encountered it as was a misseen by them. So I'm trying to show it from both sides.
Well, it was misseen, but it was also, its power was acknowledged in the sense that they were frightened of it and would destroy it at every possible opportunity.
Right. So.
And the kind of corresponding white or Christian or whatever spirituality really doesn't hold the power, at least in your book, that the African spirituality does.
Well, I think it might be because Richardson's wife is very closely involved with the Bible.
Right.
And Richardson is not. And he's got a much more secular Enlightenment approach. And he's sort of annoyed by her reliance on the Bible. He finds the Bible no match for the complexity of his own life. So it may be because Wash is coming from such a spiritual tradition, and Richardson is coming from a much more secular tradition. Richardson's spiritual tradition, as handed down from his father, is get rich. Get as rich as you can, as fast as you can. So, and that is...
Yes, that tradition is still with us today.
That is, many people pursue that as a spiritual tradition, so.
One of the other things that was very impressive to me about this book was the attention to authentic detail, both of place and of time and of language. How did you immerse yourself in the language of the early 19th century?
Well, you know, I kind of, there was a big debate about the dialect and the use of language in this book with my editors and with all the people that have helped me with this manuscript all along. I knew I wanted it to have the feel of the time, which is the front story of the book is 1820s. But I knew that if it was historically accurate, it would be somewhat distancing to the reader.
Right.
And so I had to find this sort of middle ground, which I've called a transliteration of, you know, and I also knew for sure that I did not want to have the black people speaking in some sort of dialect, which can often happen, and then white people drop their G's too, but it doesn't get written that way. So I was trying to find a middle ground where it would have the feel of that historical era, but it would be immediate to the reader.
Right.
So, but I read, and I, of course it was different speech for Richardson and Wash and Pallas. But I think one thing that guided me was an archivist said at the very beginning of the project that what we need to remember is that the people who were in this situation, owner and owned, were in a more, in some ways, more intimate relationship with each other than either of them are with any of their descendants. And so they were in one world together that's different from ours.
That's right.
And so I kind of had to work with the language so that they would, they had more in common in some ways with each other than any of them do with any of us.
It's interesting that you say that, both about their commonality with each other, which you do hear to some extent in the language, but also what you said about making it have the feel of what would have been authentic language, but not getting too detailed about that. Because, of course, I mean, in history class, you read original documents, and original documents from 1825 are almost unreadable, and you didn't do it in that language. And yet, for me, it had the feel almost of the cadences and rhythms of the way each of these people would have spoken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I really just tried to stay true to the voices as I heard them. And I think whenever you write, you are on some mysterious journey into another reality, and you want to bring as much of it back whole as you can, but because you bring it through yourself, then you have little bits of yourself all over it. So you have to go back in and knock all those off so that the thing that's here is close as you can get to the thing in that other world that you saw. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had little phrases of mine and stuff that I could see that I went back in and knocked off.
Right.
So that the voice was true to how I heard it.
How long did you work on this book?
A decade is a safe thing to say.
Really? And did you know at the beginning what you were in for?
I thought I was writing a novella.
Oh my goodness.
90 pages taking place on one day.
Wow.
Morning, noon, and night, kind of. Wrap it up, in and out.
What was that original concept about?
It was the same thing, but I was just going to handle it in one day.
Yeah.
Because this story is so sprawling that the biggest issue was how to rein it in. I mean, there's so many storylines that are cut out of this.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Marcus's childhood and, you know, a lot of... But it's such a sprawling story and it goes in so many different directions that I had to be really rigorous about containing it. And the other big issue is that, obviously, the modern Western novel is linear with this rising action to a climactic moment and then resolving at the end. And traditional African spirituality is not on that framework. And so how to write a novel that has that framework about a subject that doesn't have that framework. And the other issue is that sort of rising to this climactic event, and then when the majority of the people you're dealing with are enslaved into the foreseeable future.
That's right, because, I mean, it's another 40 years till the Civil War.
Right. I mean, this is much earlier. You know, this is the window after the Revolutionary War and then in the early 1800s. And so... But I wanted to sort of meet the needs of the modern reader in terms of, you know, narrative momentum and all of that. But also the majority of enslaved people, one way you can have that rising climactic action is a runaway or a rebellion or whatever. But that's not true to the majority of the experiences of the people who were enslaved. A lot of people wanted to stay where they had been. And Wash talks about this, wanting to stay where... in the places that he has been with his mother and so that he can keep her close to him. And so how to sort of handle the drama part of it when the person and is going to be enslaved into the foreseeable future. But then, like you said, there's other things about What interested me was, here's Richardson, the owner, who's supposed to be the one with all the power, but continually Wash seems to manage to make Richardson feel powerless. So,
I mean, that is a very interesting dynamic and a very important dynamic. I mean, what I love about this book, one of the many things, is that it gives you so much to contemplate and to take into other parts of your life. I mean, you think about the dynamic between Richardson and Wash, slave owner and enslaved man, and then you think about gender relations and who's got the power in some of these crazy male-female dynamics that we see, and all kinds of employer-employee things like that. So you were at this for 10 years, and I mean, it's a spiritual journey on the part of the characters, and presumably also on your part.
Oh, definitely. I definitely, well, as the story unfolded and I realized that it was basically, in large part, Wash's spiritual journey, I had to take one of my own. I had to take a spiritual journey of my own in order to be able to tell his. And that way it was a blessing.
Very much so. And I think, I mean, there's so much about the, well, African spirituality, African-American spirituality, and it does give one a perspective on, for example, altars and things like that. How did you learn about these things, and did you re-see the things that you'd grown up with?
Yes, and I definitely knew that I needed help, that it was bigger than me. Way bigger than me, and that I needed help from something that was bigger than me. So I had to develop spiritual practices in order to be able to bring the story into the world, in order to be able to keep working on it, in order to go where I had to go. I had to have help.
And did you see African-American culture in a new way after doing this?
I saw, the more I learned about traditional African spirituality, the more I was able to see the South that I grew up in and all the ways, how African it is. And I was profoundly influenced by a lot of outsider artists, one in particular, Lonnie Holly, who lives outside Birmingham, who carries an enormous amount of traditional African spirituality in his work. But he would not talk about that directly. I doubt he would talk about that directly. But I saw a lot of echoes. So I tried to let it echo in the story the way that it had echoed in my life.
One of the things I keep meaning to get to in asking you about this novel, Wash, is, I mean, you have this theme of slave breeding, and then you have this theme of horses, and the comparisons between those two are not lost on any reader.
Well, I think that Richardson is, well, also I think I was fascinated with a world where horses were so primary. I mean, it was 1820s, and anywhere you went there on a horse.
Right.
And I grew up with horses, and so that those connections and the dependency and the reliance and the on each other that had to happen at that time. Richardson's always riding home 3 or 4 days through the woods with his, and he and his horse are out there camping and listening to the mountain lions. And so, but he was very serious about breeding horses, and he had a horse that was descended from a famous racehorse. And that's how Wash starts the story, is he's talking about a Richardson and someone who's come to breed the mare to his stud, and them looking at the pedigree and running their finger down the names and to the point where this horse would be. And Wash was watching him do that, and that's where Wash thinks he got the idea.
Right.
And each of them has a different story about where they got the idea, which was interesting to me. What's really interesting to me is people having different stories about the same event.
Well, that's one of the beautiful things about this book, is that it's written both in the third person in some places and in the first person in others, and it is in the first person of Wash and of Richardson and of
Palace.
Wash's love, yeah. Palace and a few other people, and it's wonderful to see the same thing described by so many different people, especially when one person had a feeling of love and catharsis and the other person said, this is so gross.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it kind of goes back to an African idea about, because having grown up in a really segregated place, and where even now some groups of people talk about other groups of people in a very damaging way and don't seem to feel that that has any repercussions, I became very aware of the power of speech and the power of somebody saying something about someone else. And there's an African concept of nyama, so the words that come from your mouth, that's very powerful, and that you need to be aware that you're bringing a certain energy form into the world, that you need to be aware of what you're saying about someone. Because so many, there's such a history of especially Black people being talked about in a way that is not in their control and is not accurate to their reality. And I saw that a lot growing up and found it. So the sort of casual way that these different characters talk about each other, or the way that Palace will talk about what someone said about her. So I wanted to try to capture that sort of the casual violence of a lot of the language around race. And so one way to do that was to, you know, when Wash says, Richardson has no way of knowing what all those girls meant to me. And he goes into this long, lyrical, beautiful description of what those girls mean to him. And then he says about Richardson, well, he just thought I was a hound dog. You know, it's, and they're very aware of how they're being talked about and how they have to create their own narrative to oppose that narrative that's mistaken.
Were there any major literary influences for this book? I mean, obviously you've read huge amounts of fiction and so on, but are there any particular authors who influenced the way you conceived of and wrote this book?
Well, I think I was certainly steeped in Faulkner growing up. We were actually taken by a high school teacher to the real bridge where a fictional Quentin Compson committed suicide.
Wow.
And I remember wondering as
no
I was...
No wonder you had some confusion about fiction and
exactly,
reality.
Exactly. And I remember wondering about, when I was reading Faulkner, wondering whether the people I knew growing up were very like the people in his books. I didn't know whether it was because they were so similar to the people he wrote about, or whether they had read so much Faulkner that they, I don't know.
Right.
But Faulkner was huge, but I also felt like there were gaps there. He was a huge influence just in the fact that he took it on, but also in the ways that he took it on, with multiple voices and multiple perspectives. But I felt that there were gaps. And Alice Walker, a lot of Toni Morrison, obviously, Toni Cade Bambara, a lot of African-American women writers and a lot of African writers and African diaspora writers, and filled in a lot of the gaps. But particularly African writers also like Achebe and Soyinka, and a lot of writers that help, and Nadine Gordimer. Nadine Gordimer was huge for me when I was a child, because Birmingham was known as the Johannesburg of the South.
Okay.
And so there was a lot of similarities between. So finding her books as a child was really important. And there was a sort of a thoroughness with which she went about this issue that definitely influenced me. I'm sure there's... but then there's other writers that are not dealing with this issue that influenced me, like Leslie Marmon Silko's Almanac of the Dead.
Yeah.
Was a huge influence.
One of the great writers of our time.
Yeah. So that book changed my... enabled me to understand what this book was about.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to Margaret Rinkle about her book, Wash. Now, there's a documentary component to this. You did a lot of photography along the way?
I took a lot of photographs while I was doing research on different slavery-related sites throughout the South. And I thought originally they were just visual note-taking. But as I got home and looked through, the photographs started to give rise to scenes and themes. So I had wanted to include all 30 of them in the book, but we're down to 6. But there is also a related exhibition of the photographs, but those pieces are the photograph with the text that they gave rise to or that they're related to. And one of the reasons I really wanted to include photographs in the book is that, to me, textual literacy is not the only kind of literacy. And I think our current cultural trance that we talked about earlier sort of has put textual literacy at the center and as the most important. And I think our focus on that has led to us to not focus, that we focus on textual literacy more than visual, emotional, spiritual literacies. And learning how to read an image or learning how to read the natural world is, to me, as important as learning to read the type words on the page. And I think it's particularly important given the fact that not only were half of the characters in the book legally denied literacy, they came from an oral tradition.
And could be punished for reading.
Could be punished for reading, but also, and were controlled by written documents, and came from an oral tradition in which the literacy was seen as potentially damaging to your spiritual connection. And this is a whole long thing about, you know, the development to an abstract alphabet has happened in conjunction with rising damage to the natural world. So those dynamics are very interesting to me. But I wanted to, and also I think a lot of the enslaved people in the story are on very intimate terms with the natural world because they're sneaking through the night to see each other when they can. And they have to read situations. I mean, their safety and security is dependent on their being able to read situations very well. And so I wanted to draw attention to the fact that there's a lot of ways of reading.
What's it like to have this book finished?
It's very surreal. It's very strange. It hasn't sunk in. But it is sort of shocking to see it separate from me and moving out in the world. It's great, but it's surreal.
Well, I look forward to hearing how the rest of the world responds to it. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This has been a rebroadcast of an interview with Margaret Rinkle, author of the novel Wash, which is available at Collected Works Bookstore and many other bookstores.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafemc. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter @radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.